You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Well, Merry Christmas, Daniel.
Merry Christmas, Richard.
Merry Christmas, Lionel.
Ho, 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 Richard.
Oh, that's good.
Who would be playing Scrooge if we did this is a Christmas special, isn't it?
Who do you think?
Well, I would say Napalm.
I love Christmas. I'm very Christmassy. I'm Scrooge like the other 51 weeks of the year, but at Christmas I go completely the other way.
Do you? I don't believe that.
No, I do like
not
Christmas.
For a second.
I do. I enjoy the nice wind down into Christmas and all the food and everything as you'd expect. I like Christmas.
Do you like Christmas pudding?
I do like Christmas pudding, yeah, but I prefer Christmas cake.
Oh, really? Mm. Interesting.
How about you?
My first Christmas in France, and we're struggling to get some of the things that we really enjoy at Christmas, like Christmas crackers, for example. Can't get Christmas crackers over here.
Are you, Richard, because your wife has Polish heritage, do you do a traditional Polish Christmas Eve dinner, like my family does?
Well, we do a Christmas Eve dinner, yeah, rather than Christmas Day.
But no,
but that's a French thing as well, isn't it?
No beetroot soup.
No beetroot soup. No. Other than that, quite traditional. But yeah, Christmas pudding. We've had sent from the UK, brandy butter, and getting Christmas crackers delivered by Lizzie Banks on Sunday. She's passing this way on her way to Girona. So she's going to come and stay Sunday night and maybe go for a bike ride on Monday in this area. So that's very kind. She's bringing cheddar cheese and Christmas crackers. What have you asked for? What are you getting for Christmas, Lionel?
Well, I've already had my gift from Simon the photographer, one of his fantastic jigsaw puzzles, which he dropped off the other day. And I've cleared the dining room table to start putting it together. A 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle, which when completed will show Geraint Thomas and Chris Froome climbing Alpe d'Huez, one of Simon's
I've heard that Chris Froome has got that jigsaw, and he's put it together with omitting Geraint Thomas from the picture.
Yeah, for Chris Froome, it's a 440-piece jigsaw puzzle.
And Daniel, what are you getting for Christmas?
A vaccine. No, actually, vaccine is my present to my girlfriend. I'm getting a heart rate monitor, hopefully. I haven't used a heart rate monitor for many years, but I'm kind of against the whole... I'm against equipment generally for for running, cycling, but particularly running in my case. But I've succumbed. You know, usually I like to run bare-chested. Why do I want to know my heart rate? I had the same problem always in cycling. I'm very warm-paced. I find it difficult to go any faster than I currently go, and I find it difficult to go any slower than I currently go. And I feel that heart rate-based training will help me to regulate my speed a bit better, Rich.
Wow. Any coaches out there want to take on Daniel, please get in touch. contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. Well, while we're talking about Christmas presents, a couple of quick mentions before we get into the news roundup. And in today's episode, we are going to be looking back on our moments of the year. And in the final part will be my Christmas quiz, which is not a patch on Rose Manley's Christmas quiz in the Cycling Podcast Femini. It's very entertaining. This one, I've done my best. I've got some questions for Daniel and Lionel. Before we go on, though, I on the Turbo Train the other day, I watched The Racer, a new film about, set in Ireland in 1998 and the start of the Tour de France. Now, adapting cycling stories for the big screen, and this will be in cinemas, apparently, from the 18th of December, which is in a couple of days. It's also on all the usual platforms. You'll be able to watch it from the 18th of December. But I quite enjoyed it. Did you watch it, Daniel?
No, Richard. I've seen the trailer. Haven't yet seen the full movie yet.
It's challenging to depict bike racing, and especially the Tour de France, on the screen. But they've done an all right job. Yeah, I think cycling fans will quite enjoy it.
Yeah, sporting adaptations of sporting events, sports, always difficult, isn't it? And movies. I always find that American movies adapting or showing American sports do a better job of it, but that's maybe because, you know, I don't have the learned eye which would enable me to see the sort of inconsistencies and see, you know, the ways in which it's hammed up. But maybe American listeners can tell me. For example, things like, I don't know, Any Given Sunday seem quite realistic to me. Even, you know, the scenes in Friday Night Lights, high school football, you know, they seem to be very well done to me, but I'm not sure about European films.
The bike racing is hard. I'd say this one's better than The Program in terms of how it depicts cycling. I mean, some of it is ridiculous, obviously, but the main actor who plays a rider is a cyclist himself and reasonably convincing, if a little bit too large to be a Tour de France
rider.
How
does it measure up to, I get them mixed up, what the two American cycling films from the 80s, one with Kevin Costner and Jennifer Grey, American Flyers?
American Flyers,
and
yeah.
And what's the other one?
Breaking Away.
Which one's which? Which one is
Breaking
the one?
Breaking Away is about the Italian kid, isn't it?
Yes, that's often been, it's often been levelled at me that I had a, well, hang
it's
on.
It's your story, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
Well, it's well worth a watch, The Racer. I also mentioned the new Rafa book, The Racing Secrets of Rafael Gimignani, who is a legendary figure. He was a rider himself and then looked after Jacques Anquetil. He's still alive. He's around Clermont-Ferrand, isn't he? Because we talked about him when we were there at the Tour de France. And it's a beautiful little book by Isabel Best that's just been published. And another Christmas gift idea is, of course, Friend of the Podcast subscription, which you can buy as a gift. How do you do that, Lionel?
Well, you go to thecyclingpodcast.com/friends, and then just at the top of the page, there's a list of the sort of frequently asked questions about how the whole system works, or you can just go straight to join, and there's an option to give a subscription as a gift as well. So if you want to sign somebody else up, if you're already a friend of the podcast and you think somebody else would enjoy access to the Friends of the Podcast episodes, you can give the gift of a subscription for a year.
The gift of friendship. What more could you ask for at Christmas? Do you have a news roundup for us, please, Lionel?
I do. A few brief items of news to cover this week. First of all, the UCI has been busy announcing a range of safety measures, one of which is something we talked about on the Cycling Podcast in light of the crash at the Tour of Poland, which was standardising and improving the barriers on the side of the road. The UCI are introducing some improved safety measures there, and they've also unveiled a concussion protocol. Now, this is quite a long document. You can read it on the UCI's website if you wish to find out more about it. And I think in the new year, we'll ask Ian Boswell what his thoughts are on this. But in brief, the idea is that non-health professionals working within the peloton will be trained to recognise the signs of concussion, because obviously the first people on the scene of a crash are usually the mechanics, sports directors and other riders. So if they are all familiar with the telltale signs of concussion, they may be able to help intervene and save a rider from the instinct of just pushing on with potentially a head injury. There's some other measures about what length of time riders would have to sit out if they are diagnosed with concussion, complete rest for between 24 and 48 hours, and not returning to competition for at least a week after their symptoms have cleared up, which obviously has pretty dramatic implications in stage racing. So that's a really kind of hot topic in a lot of sports at the moment, and the UCI is addressing that, but it would be good to tackle that in the new year and find out what some of the riders think about that. Tom Pidcock won his biggest cyclocross event so far of his career, a super prestige race in Havera. A solo win well ahead of Matthew van der Poel and Toon Aerts. It was his first elite cyclocross win. And, well, he's joining Ineos on the road after the end of the cyclocross season in the spring, isn't he? The UAE Team Emirates rider Diego Ulissi, who won two stages of the Giro, earlier on this year, has been diagnosed with a heart condition, myocarditis, and could be out for several months while he is monitored and it's deemed that it's safe for him to continue racing. Ricardo Rico has been handed a lifetime ban. Now, Daniel, he was due to return to racing at some point in the, well, quite distant future. I think he's
2024.
2024, wasn't it? But the ban has been extended to a lifetime ban. So any thoughts of a comeback of any kind dashed. I don't think there was a... Was there a serious... There was some talk of Rico coming back, wasn't there? He had said that he would try to come back.
Well, no, there'll be no comeback to cycling, but of course he's... career as a gelataio, an ice cream maker, has been thriving the last few years.
That's unaffected by this, is it?
he opened a new gelateria in Vignola, just outside Modena, where he's from recently. Choco Loco, I think it's called. And by all accounts, they do a very fine vanilla, apparently.
Interesting.
I'd be very wary of some of the dark red chocolates in his range of ice creams. the dark red ice creams, rather, in his range.
We should, Napalm, point out that so Ricardo Rico was, well, he was infamous for a doping scandal that erupted at the 2008 Tour de France when he actually tested positive. And then subsequently there was the story about him attempting a bit of a DIY blood transfusion, and that led to a second ban. This latest offence, or what's have triggered the lifetime ban, is a pretty murky affair involving him trying to buy drugs, I believe, in 2015. There was also a former, I think it was a Napoli footballer, who has also been sanctioned for the same affair, which occurred in Tuscany, I believe.
There was the Esports World Championships, the first ever edition. 50-kilometer races held on Zwift, and the women's race was won by Ashley Moulman-Passio ahead of Sarah Giganti, and the men's race was won by a 26-year-old professional rower, a German called Jason Osborne, who, when asked by worldrowing.com who his favourite other sports person was, said Primoz Roglic. And Osborne has raced on the road as well. He was sixth in the 2019 German Time Trial Championships, just a minute and 27 slower than Tony Martins. And finally, another team name change to get to grips with next year. Bahrain, who of course are no longer going to be linked with the McLaren supercar company, are going to be called Bahrain Victorious, which strikes me as a little presumptuous. Two World Tour wins to their name in 2020. Maybe they should just be Bahrain until they actually get a win on the board. I don't know.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iwalker.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
Thanks very much to iWalker, our title sponsor, who have partnered with Mental Health UK to develop a model offering support for small businesses, ranging from practical tools available to everyone through to personal attention for individuals where needed. If you run a small business and you're interested in this, there's a survey that you can fill in and find at iwoca.co.uk that will help them understand the issues that their customers face. As iWalker say, the pandemic has forced small businesses to endure even more challenges than in normal times, and this has shone a light on the mental health of the small business owners in particular and their resilience in weathering the impacts on their businesses and employees. For more information on the partnership with Mental Health UK and everything else that iWalker can do for small businesses, go to iwoca.co.uk. That's iwoca.co.uk. Well, each of us is going to pick a moment from the year. This is our way of, I suppose, reviewing the year, the season, we're doing so through a moment that each of us picks. You go first, Daniel. What's your moment of the year?
Well, Rich, I think it's probably the image of most people's cycling season this year, and that is the image, not so much of Primoz Roglic crossing the line at La Planche des Belfis on the penultimate stage of the Tour de France, but of his teammates, particularly Tom Dumoulin and Wout van Aert, watching the disaster unfold for Roglic and Jumbo-Visma. I think, you know, the view I had of it, and was pretty similar to what people saw on TV, because I was standing in the mix zone just behind the finish line, which was actually where Dumoulin and Van Aert were watching. And they'd been there for 20 minutes or so, and you know, their expression had become progressively, you know, more concerned as time had passed. I remember interviewing Sepp Kuss. He'd finished his time trial, and the interview I did with him was kind of similar to the ones I'd done with other Jumbo-Visma riders when they'd finished their time trial. They were quite sort of blasé, matter-of-fact, really, about Primoz Roglic's chances of holding on, as we all expected him to do. But as I was talking to Sepp Kuss, I remember there were updates coming through, and there were time gaps coming through, and it was looking slightly dicey for Roglic. And I remember saying to Sepp that, oh, it wasn't going too well. But even then, you know, it seemed almost inconceivable that what came to pass would come to pass. But, you know, it's a moment that I think will really, well, define this year's cycling season, and it will become one of the most famous images in Tour de France history, particularly that sort of shot of Van Aert and Dumoulin.
It's funny that I was going to go for that day as well, but that is the most obvious image, the Van Aert, Dumoulin, you know, arms crossed in front of them, and Van Aert was wearing a face mask, wasn't he, and Dumoulin wasn't, and it was a look of sort of horror just on their faces. But it was a day that threw up so many images, actually. I mean, from Pogacar warming up in this very kind of casual fashion with his headphones on and his cap on and looking incredibly relaxed. That was quite striking even at the time. And then Roglic himself looking increasingly ragged on the climb, you know, and that smoothness that we've come to expect, that fluidity of Roglic just kind of going, and the helmet, you know, at an angle, and he was almost unraveling before our eyes, you know, and it's all relative. And there was this debate afterwards about whether Roglic had actually cracked or not, given that he was, I think, fourth on the stage, wasn't he? But in relative terms, he did crack, you know, and Pogacar put in an extraordinary performance to win ahead of guys like Dumoulin as well, let's not forget. But it was a day that just threw up so many iconic sort of images that will come to define this season and that tour.
I think you say there, Rich, that he did crack, but I think, you know, one of the legacies of that day is that question of whether it was a genuine choke. And I think that's something that'll be debated through the ages. I mean, I think pretty much immediately afterwards, people pointed out that, well, actually, the result hadn't been that catastrophic for Roglic, in the sense that he finished the time trial 1 minute 56 behind Pogacar. His cushion, his advantage at the start of the day had been 57 seconds. So, you know, he obviously conceded a lot of time, almost 3 minutes to Pogacar, which sounds bad, but fifth on the stage. But, you know, you think of the great chokes in sporting history. I think the one for British audiences that always comes to mind is Jana Novotná in the 93 Wimbledon final, where she was 4-1 up on Steffi Graf and one or two breaks up in the final set, and then started double faulting, started missing volleys, and was famous as well for the aftermath of that match, because she was sort of consoled by, was it Princess? Help me out here, champs. Royal family, the blonde lady.
Princess Michael.
Not Princess Anne.
Michael of Kent.
Princess Michael of Kent. Yes. But quite an iconic image. A lot of people actually forget that Jana Novotná won Wimbledon, I think 5 years after that. She returned and she sort of exercised that ghost, conquered her demons. Another one in the 1996 US Masters golf tournament, where Greg Norman led by six shots going into the final day and was overhauled spectacularly by Nick Faldo, completely fell apart. But I mean, can you ever really talk about choking in professional cycling? I mean, I always associate choking more with event or disciplined sports where the emphasis is really on the fine motor skills. I always think that in sports like cycling, And because it's to do with motion, it's to do with kind of the big muscle groups, that sort of helps to counteract the nervousness and the tension when you're sort of moving, when all it is sort of, in the case of professional cycling, pushing as hard as possible on the pedals. I always wonder whether you can really talk about choking, whether it is a thing, although there's no doubt that muscle tension can manifest itself.
But yeah, that's almost to regard the riders as robots and not and to discount the mental aspect. And I think as soon as you throw the mental aspect into the mix, then you've got, you know, whether it's a slightly different form of choking or not, I think how would it manifest itself? It's almost a sense of panic. I mean, if Roglic was aware that he was losing time and he just began to think, and it can be just the act of thinking.
In research about choking, I mean, that is essentially what it boils down to. It's usually a level of self-consciousness.
Yes.
About things which previously would have come automatically.
I think that's the great contradiction about this day. On the one hand, Roglic, if you told him in the morning you'll finish 35 seconds behind Tom Dumoulin on this stage, what would the odds of winning the Tour de France have been? They would have been pretty well stacked in his favour. The extraordinary thing was Pogacar's performance. I mean, it was an absolute rout. He didn't just rout Roglic, he routed Dumoulin. 1:21 ahead of Dumoulin. And you know, Richie Porte as well, no slouch in time trials, despite, you know, some of my erroneous commentary during the Tour de France in the lead-up to that time trial on La Porte de Belfort.
I missed that. Thanks for reminding us of that.
I just thought I'd chuck that in there. Yeah, we occasionally get things wrong, don't we?
With all the drama of that stage, we kind of maybe didn't pay enough attention to your very poor predicting game, Lionel, going into it regarding Lopez and Porte.
Yeah, well, quite. So we should revisit. I mean,
let's spend the next 10 minutes talking about that.
Very much a secondary storyline, though, that. So we don't need to. There's probably time for me to go and get that edited out of all of the last week of the Tour de France episodes. But the when, Daniel, you were listing sort of great moments, great collapses in British sporting history, you can't really complete that list without Devon Locke, the Queen Mother's racehorse that fell in the final straight of the Grand National in 1956. And, you know, that's a kind of sporting collapse. I mean,
wow.
That is the kind of iconic sporting collapse, you know, victory in the bag, only for
and what happened there? Did the horse overthink it? What did the horse say afterwards about it?
I think the horse did start overthinking it. But the point about Roglic and Pogacar on that final time trial was, you know, Roglic was doing okay, he was doing absolutely fine, until the moment that he was aware that Pogacar was making such gains. And then your description of it as sinking, Rich, I think is good, because suddenly what he was doing was not enough, and it was slipping away. And I think the moment it becomes a proper crack is symbolized by just the helmet slipping and the way he looked. He did look ragged. He looked like it had just all got away from him
in the final, he looked pale, didn't he?
That would have been the fact that it was sinking in, that he had managed, well, you know, victory had slipped away in quite a dramatic fashion, and he'd just not been able to keep a grasp on it. And it didn't happen in a minute or a kilometre. It happened slowly, probably without realising at first, and then when perhaps he did realise, it was too late to respond. And then the more he tried to kind of rein in the losses, you know, the losses are not coming in at all, and in fact going the other way, and then the panic sets in. You can just, without even, you know, being party to what he was thinking on the climb, you can just imagine that every effort to try and limit those losses. We say it so glibly, don't we?
I can imagine his little internal monologue just going shit.
Well, you would pay a pretty penny to really be able to unpick that. What did he think at every moment? It's a real fascinating question, and we probably won't get the answer from Roglic himself necessarily, you know, while he is a rider. But maybe one day he'll be able to go through that. You know, it might be a sort of almost a therapy session for him at some point, depending on how the rest of his career goes. But just fascinating to to think about the mental process. Suddenly, sort of 55 minutes must have felt like it was over in the blink of an eye, and yet sort of an interminable length of time. You know, it must have been...
Remember, I just very quickly, briefly on that, remember in Four Weddings and a Funeral when Hugh Grant sleeps in and he's late for a wedding, and the sheer panic and the kind of muttering and swearing under his breath as he realises the implications of this and races the car. That's why I imagine Roglic's internal monologue.
His bike change looked a bit like that, didn't it? But easy, very easy, chaps, to say after the event. But that morning, I was slightly worried for Rog because I'd been dispatched to the foot of the climb because, riders were doing their recons. And for ITV, I was working for, we wanted some footage of teams, riders practicing bike changes. So we stationed ourselves on the bottom of the climb, and I spoke to someone from UAE that morning, and they said, change of plan, Tadej Pogačar is not going to do a recon. And then shortly after that, we saw Rog come through looking very, very focused, more sort of focused, and like he was doing more of a kind of proper recon, proper trial, dry run than the previous riders we'd seen that morning. And, you know, I just had this kind of image in my head of Pog in the sort of spirit of, you know, spontaneity and nonchalance in which he'd ridden the Tour de France, sort of, you know, being sat up in bed with his bowl of cornflakes, watching Whack-A-Day, very relaxed, and just, you know, having no real anxiety about the day. And then we'd seen Rog go past looking very tense, and also... You know, there was this narrative, there had been this narrative about him weakening in the last week and weakening particularly in the final time trial of Grand Tours. And I just, you could almost feel some of that tension again, you know, with 2020 hindsight. And you know, sure enough, the respective performances that day seemed to bear that out, you know. Pogačar, almost a sort of happy-go-lucky kind of approach to the time trial, and which, you know, bore fruit. And then Rog kind of cramping up and looking sort of, well, just knotted with tension. But one thing that does strike me is that maybe the what happened at the Vuelta, where he did hang on Roglic perversely, does that debunk the theory of a choke? Because even there, we saw, and I think this almost proved beyond doubt, that he does struggle right at the end of Grand Tours. And could it simply have been, was it simply, and should it be remembered simply as, you know, further evidence of that at the Tour de France, that he was just running out of fuel at that point?
Well, just one final thing from that day, because another image was of Rog at the finish, you know, having crossed the line and suffered this devastating loss. His first reaction, his first instinct was to get up and go and congratulate Pog. And I think in that moment, he made himself a lot more popular than if he'd actually won the Tour, because it really showed that it was the measure of him. You know, we don't get a lot from Rog. He's pretty inscrutable. He doesn't give a lot away. But we sort of, I guess, got a sense of who he is in that moment. And it was it reflected very well on him. I thought his attitude, his first response was to go and give Pog a very sincere kind of congratulations.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Harry's. Richard, you're always raving about shaving with Harry's razors.
Oh, that's nice wordplay there, Lionel. Well, I have to tell you, I am a Harry's customer, as you know. And the other day, we moved to France fairly recently. Well, recently enough that we haven't unpacked everything yet. I was running low on my Harry's cartridges, and I found a stash in a box. and I was so happy because it meant that I didn't have to go out and buy some terrible French razors.
Oh dear.
No offense, France.
Like a sort of a little Aladdin's cave, I imagine you unpacking, and that would be just uncovering those replacement cartridges. That's another few months. Really, what you're saying, Rich, is if I smartened up my act and started shaving again, I should do so with Harry's.
Yeah, definitely. It's a very, very pleasing experience. I always enjoy shaving with Harry's. Jeff and Andy, who set up Harry's, bought their own factory in Germany, a factory that's been making razor blades for 100 years now, say that they've released recently their sharpest ever blades. And they're the same price. Replacement blades are as little as £1.75 each. And yeah, I'm very happy with my Harry's shaves. It keeps me fresh face, as you know, Lionel.
Well, although I'm going more for the tough paper round look, Rich, with my grizzled face, I have recommended Harry's razors to other people and they've been very happy, starting off with the trial set and then graduating to getting the replacement blades delivered to their door. So you don't even have to sort of put them in the supermarket trolley or add them to the supermarket shop. They turn up periodically as you need to replace them. So a very good system. And if you'd like to give it a go, you can get started with a trial set, which includes, Richard?
Well, it includes a weighted ergonomic handle, a new 5-blade razor cartridge, rich lathering shave gel, and the travel blade cover to protect your blades on the move. So to get the comfortable shave that you deserve, head to harrys.com/cycling to claim a trial set for just £3.95. You'll also be supporting the Cycling Podcast by doing so. Again, head to harrys.com/cycling. Well, my moment of the year is a more somber one, but also kind of fitting for this COVID-ravaged year. Lanciano, start of stage 10 of the Giro d'Italia, followed the first rest day in Abruzzo. We had a lovely day there, very nice meal in one of these kind of huts in the sea, built out into the sea, a fisherman's hut that kind of dot that coast.
Yes, Rich, called Trabocchi.
Trabocchi, and very cold, but it was nice. And we went to Lanciano the next morning, knowing that the COVID tests had just been announced, and there were fears at the Giro that the protocols weren't quite as well managed as they'd been at the Tour de France. I'd done an interview on the rest day with Jos van Emden of Jumbo-Visma, where he'd been very scathing, in fact, about some of the hotels they'd stayed in and the contact they'd had with the public. And we got to the start in Lanciano, having learned that Stephen Kruijswijk had tested positive for coronavirus. This was a few days after Simon Yates had tested positive, and there were a couple of more positive cases on his team, Mitchelton Scott, so they decided to withdraw from the race. We got to the start in Lanciano, small town, and Jumbo-Visma were there, and we went to the sort of mix zone, intercepting the riders as they went down to sign on. I spoke to Alex Dowsett, I remember, about his stage win a couple of days earlier, and gradually it dawned on us that no Jumbo-Visma rider had appeared to sign on, and they seemed to be all still on the bus. And then there was a whisper that they were actually not going to take the start. And Adi Engels walked past us looking very stern-faced and serious and with real purpose. And he went to see the organisation and told them that they had decided not to start. And then he came back to speak to us. And I was really struck by how serious his demeanour was. It was obviously a huge decision and a really difficult decision to pull out of a Grand Tour, and it felt hugely significant. You know, at that moment, just a week into a 3-week race with two teams out and several other cases, I really didn't think the Giro was going to make it to Milan. And I thought Engels spoke very well, explaining that they felt they were doing that they were pulling out for the benefit of the race, to give the race a chance, and they felt that it was the responsible thing to do, to pull out the race. So it was a very, very somber. Now, it does seem amazing that the Giro kind of, you know, dusted itself off, carried on, and did make it to Milan, and it ended up being obviously a terrific race.
I think when we look back on this season, Rich, my image as far as kind of COVID is concerned will be a different one. It would be from Paris-Nice. And because at that point in the year, in March, when the pandemic was really, well, cranking up all across Europe, we really didn't know what we were dealing with. And it did feel quite apocalyptic. And as the days had gone past, there'd been more and more measures introduced, announced, and the crowds had been sort of cleared away completely. And we were going through parts of France, which are very quiet anyway. And then we got to stage five, and Lawson Craddock had abandoned the race near the end of the stage. And then just as we were wrapping up off our interviews after the finish, we heard a rumour that Lawson Craddock was being tested for COVID. And then we got a glimpse of him being sort of kind of bundled into the back of an ambulance to do this test. And then, you know, he was taken away with sort of sirens wailing, and it really did feel quite apocalyptic. And I don't know if you've seen, a lot of people have rewatched it since the start of the pandemic, the film Contagion, which is an eerily sort of similar foreshadowing of what we've been through this year. I think the film was made in about 2011, but it felt very much like that. So that would be my image of this very strange year. I felt, you know, by the time we got to the Giro, we sort of knew what we were dealing with. I mean, we personally, we'd done a few races by that point. And, you know, it was unfortunate, but we always felt at the Giro, didn't we, that it was on a knife edge the whole time.
Well, that sort of leads to my moment of the year, which was Super Sunday, Sunday, October the 18th. And I'd been thinking about how COVID-19 had kept the crowds away to a great extent at the Tour de France, and how we'd all talked, hadn't we, about how road racing really wasn't all that diminished when compared to some other sports by the absence of spectators. Now, that's not to say that there isn't something magical about watching a race from the side of the road, and there isn't something added to the atmosphere and the experience of watching a race, you know, when the riders are going up the mountains, you know, through a corridor of spectators. You know, that has its good and its less good points, I think. But in terms of the television spectacle, cycling wasn't harmed, I didn't feel, by the absence of spectators on the roadside. Certainly not as much as, say, football, which, you know, a stadium sport, played in front of no spectators, or as we've seen in recent weeks, just a couple of thousand people allowed into some games. You know, it's not the same experience. And there's a sense watching football that the actual sport is diminished because there aren't people watching it. There's just something lacking, whether it be you know, the sense that the players pick up on a sort of echoey arena, and it's just not as perhaps full-blooded, it's not as meaningful maybe. Whereas the Grand Tours and the Classics went ahead, I felt, in a sporting sense, it very much in the same way. And I think Super Sunday, which was stage 15 of the Giro to Piancavallo, which was won by Teo Gegenhardt ahead of the two Sunweb riders, Wilco Kelderman and Jai Hindley. And that was a day when João Almeida really dug very, very deep, rode heroically to cling on to his pink jersey by 15 seconds. It was a real cracking stage of a Giro that was starting to you know, bubble pretty nicely by that stage with a week to go. And that taking place on the same afternoon as the Tour of Flanders, which finally gave us this head-to-head between Mathieu van der Poel and Wout van Aert, which I guess everyone's been waiting for a long time, to see their rivalry, which lasted a long time in cyclocross, goes back to almost a decade, really. I mean, the pair of them were on the podium at the Junior Cyclocross World Championships back in 2012, when van der Poel won and van Aert was second. They went head-to-head in so many cyclocross races. You know, they've won three world cyclocross titles each, and with both of them having, you know, a real, you know, quality in the classic races, we were anticipating the beginning of a Van der Poel Van Aert rivalry, which could last many years. And we finally saw them head to head in the Tour of Flanders. If you think about when the sport returned after lockdown, you know, Wout van Aert really hit the ground running, didn't he? He won very impressive at Strade Bianca, very impressive at Milan San Remo. But it seemed everything that Wout van Aert could do, Mathieu van der Poel was doing something equally impressive. The Binkbank Tour, he won with a sensational solo break on the final day, a little bit overshadowed because that was also the first day of the Giro d'Italia. And so everything was set up for the Tour of Flanders, and the pair of them got away with Julian Alaphilippe, and then Alaphilippe came to grief when he clipped that motorcycle, and that left the two of them out in front on their own, and it was a sort of 40-kilometre guessing game. Who was going to do what? Would they try to attack one another? Would they leave it to the sprint? And in the end, they left it to the sprint, and, well, it came down to what? Less than half a wheel. It was a real close finish. Matthew van der Poel got it. You know, Wout van Aert's day will surely come. But what that said to me, really, was that the racing was the star a lot of the time over this condensed and very intense period of racing from the start of August through to the beginning of November. The absence of fans was felt in some ways, but didn't diminish the actual spectacle. But then as a television sport, you know, spoiled with this kind of afternoon of great racing, one event after another. And yet, in the kind of final analysis, neither Matthew van der Poel's Tour of Flanders win nor Theo Gegenhardt's stage win, and in actual fact his Giro d'Italia win as well, because by the time he was clinching the Giro, the Vuelta was already underway. I do feel that that was a lesson for pro cycling as well. Going forward, the emphasis should be on giving the best events, you know, sole status in the spotlight, so that we can really kind of absorb the classics, the Grand Tours and the major stage races without all of these different things kind of competing for attention. Because I do feel that both of those days racing kind of took a little bit away from each other. We would have been celebrating Van der Poel's fantastic head-to-head victory over Van Aert probably a bit more had we not just been pressing on again with the Giro days later.
It's like a state when you're at a stage race, you know, the day before is very quickly forgotten, isn't it? It's one of the good things about it, about going back to revisit some of these things. But mentioning the lack of crowds, you know, when I think of the three outstanding images of the year, when you talk about the Tour of Flanders, there was some fantastic photography that day. There always is great photography at the Tour of Flanders of the crowds, you know, the on the climbs and the riders kind of threading their way through. But the photography, the images of Van der Poel and Van Aert together against a kind of naked landscape were absolutely stunning, as were the pictures from Imola at the World Championships, Anna van der Breggen on the Saturday and Julian Alaphilippe on the Sunday. Probably the Anna van der Breggen sequence, it wasn't really a still, it was, you know, the shot from the helicopter was even better, for, you know, the light was just right and it looked amazing. And then the third one would be Gegenhardt, Rowan Dennis and Jai Hindley up the Stelvio, you know, with no spectators at all. It sort of took it into the realms of mountaineering or something. You know, it was like an assault on Everest rather than a climb in a Grand Tour. It was different, but very, very
almost like the 50s.
Yeah,
you know?
It was
the shots of Coppi and Bartoli together. Just the great thing about the races is it is this marriage of humanity, the riders and the landscape. But I think you can take the crowds away and the battle of the, you know, that solitude of the riders against the landscape still stands up, I think. Mm. And that tracking shot at Imola that you mentioned, I mean, it was jaw-dropping, wasn't it? I mean, it stood repeating over both the races. That probably wouldn't have been possible with crowds, because the crowds would have been stood on the road kind of getting in the way of the perfect arty shot.
Yeah.
So there were some positives to come out of that. Not that I'm saying that cycling should be a sport that should be held behind closed doors in the future. But, you know, in terms of watching the racing, it did feel different. And we'll be able to, assuming that in 2021 things return to a little bit closer to normal, we'll be able to date those photographs, won't we? In 30 years' time, we'll just be able to say, well, that's obviously 2020 because there's nobody there.
And Lionel, you talk about the lack of crowds at Flanders and the lack of hype and fanfare both before and after, because, you know, that's a big aspect, particularly of the classics, the number of people at the side of the road, the amount of attention and interest in Belgium in particular. But to me, the nature of this season, the way races, one race rolled immediately into the next one, and, you know, these huge races that were overlapping, that helped make for me Primoz Roglic the perfect sort of emblematic figure of this season, because You know, he's someone who does just roll from race to race. He rolled from victory to victory. He has this very sort of stoic air about him, not really interested in the fanfare. The landscape in Primoz Roglic's head, you think, you feel the way he approaches the sport is almost as desolate as those landscapes that you described. Not in the sense that there's nothing going on there, but in the sense that, you know, his conception of the sport seems to me very sort of stripped down and very kind of appealing for that reason. There's no kind of fuss. And so I think he almost epitomizes, personifies this year. The other thing you're talking about, photos. I mean, if we were to talk about photos of the year, very significant sort of photos that we each took in our mind's eye. One that I don't think I'll forget is the image as the Giro d'Italia was leaving Enna on stage. What was it?
Three or four of the
Giro d'Italia. Rich and I had gone wrong. We'd taken the wrong
unusually
road, to trying to get out of the start. And we'd stopped at a junction and we saw Theo Gegenhardt looking around, looking over his shoulder in a fairly panicked fashion, it looked to us, as though something had gone wrong, something had happened. We didn't know at that point that about 500 metres further up the road, Geraint Thomas had crashed. And what a significant turn of events that proved to be, because at that moment, neither he nor we could possibly have imagined that was his gateway to Giro glory opening up.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport, our longtime supporter. We're grateful to them for their support. And do stock up on your Science in Sport products using the discount code 25% off with the code SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. That's SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. Just before we move on, and we're going to hear from my young rider, Joe Laverick, in a minute. He is a young British rider who rode for the AG2R development team this year, but is joining a new team for next year, not yet announced. And he's going to live in Girona and is concerned about what impact Brexit might have on him. And he put a shout out on social media about that and looking for advice. So I thought I'd get his thoughts about it. So we'll hear from him in a moment. Daniel.
Well, we're not going to speak about Brexit, are we? Because if you put me on the spot and you ask me about Brexit, you get a rant very similar to, I don't know if you heard overnight, Tom Cruise's rant about the people not observing COVID protocols on the set of Mission Impossible 7.
We'll not do that. You know, it's Christmas, Daniel. We're going to get into Christmas quiz quite soon. That'll put everyone in a really good mood.
I'll tell you what, after the quiz, Daniel can talk about Brexit, and we'll just ask the producer just to fade him down gradually.
Fade it out. Before we hear from Joe, thanks to everybody who's signed up as a friend of the podcast, who's renewed or signed up as a new friend of the podcast. It's £15. That's an annual fee, and it'll gain you access to all our latest friend specials and quite a few old ones as well. There's quite a big back catalogue, about 25 episodes on there now. The next episode comes out this week, The Fan Clubs. It's a very detailed look at rider fan clubs with our listener Nigel Manson, who suggested the idea. And it has been fantastic fun, I have to say. And it sort of ends with a call to action to the podcast listeners to set up a couple of fan clubs for a male and a female rider. And we've kind of made a start with one of them. So I don't want to spoil it, but it's a really fun listen, and it was fun to do. If you become a good friend or a best friend of the podcast, i.e. if you pay a bit more, £50 or £100, you'll get either a casquette or a tea towel if you pay £50, or both if you pay £100. Now, they're not being sent out yet, are they, Lionel? You're sending them all out yourself. Books last year. You're doing these items this year.
I will be, yeah. Well, everyone who's signing up or their subscription is renewing, just on that, actually, if you're an existing friend, your subscription will renew automatically on the anniversary that you signed up, unless you disable that option. So any problems, just contact us contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. But if you can refrain from asking about the tea towel and casquette just for the moment, because what we will do is when we are in possession of the tea towel is in production now and won't be available until we think around mid-January. But once we've got both items in our possession, we will be emailing all 50 and £100 friends. The £50 friends will be asked to make their choice of which gift they would like, and everyone will be asked to send us their postal address so that we can post out those gifts. So hold fire for now, and we will do all of that in mid-January. Another bit of business on the Friends of the Podcast systems, because if you remember, we switched over from our rather homemade system, which we ran from 2015 to 2019. It was an individual feed each year. We upgraded it somewhat for 2020, and now it's this kind of rolling system, much easier to add to your device and get access to the Friends specials. As a result of our upgrade to this new system, we're taking the 2015 to 2019 feeds offline sometime towards the end of January. If you would like to save any of the episodes that are on those feeds, you can do so. You'll be able to just download them in the normal way. If you don't know how to do that, check out our newsletter this week. There'll be instructions in there so that if you want to, just make sure you don't lose access to one of your episodes, perhaps one of your favourites from those years. You'll be able to download them and keep them, store them on your computer or your phone or whatever. But over the next however many months, we'll be adding some of the back catalogue to the existing Friends of the Podcast feed, won't we, Richard? We've already done that with some of the most popular episodes. We'll carry on sort of transferring things across in due time.
Yes, and we've got some new Friends specials coming out soon as well, so stay tuned for details. We'll be putting out a Christmas bonus episode next week as well, a chat with Amara Terra, the band that provide our Giro d'Italia music. They were in the news recently because they were booked to do a Strictly Come Dancing kind of spin-off show, but the BBC were not offering them any fee, so they didn't do it, and that story made The Guardian and provoked quite a big reaction from our listeners. And in that episode next week, you'll find out how, if you want to support Amara Terra or, you know, show your appreciation for their music, which has made such a fantastic contribution to our coverage over the last 5 years, I think, we'll tell you how to do so. So that's coming next week, a little treat. But let's hear from Joe Laverick. He's just turned 20. I mean, I feel for riders who are junior or under 23. They've missed a year, basically. And these are important years for these guys if they want to become professional riders. Joe does. He's a young British rider. He's made plans to go to live in Girona next year. But he kind of falls between, is he professional amateur? Will he be allowed to go and live there under the new conditions, depending on what, if any, Brexit deal is got? And he asked on social media whether anybody had any advice for him. So I thought I'd phone him up and just find out what he knows and what he's thinking about his hoped for year in Girona next year. Quick update on Joe before we hear from him. He has signed for 2021 for Hagens Berman Action, the development team run by Axel Merckx, a very famous development team now because so many of the winners of big races recently have come through that system. He wasn't sure he could say when I spoke to him that he'd signed for them, but it's out there now. So Joe will ride for Hagens Berman Action in 2021. Established pros who are on contracts and so on, it's there'll be a lot more kind of certainty. But for other guys who want to base themselves in Europe, next year, British guys, I mean, it there's a lot of uncertainty. And I just wondered how that was, you know, weighing on your mind and making you sort of anxious about next year.
So to be honest, I hadn't really thought about it until yesterday, really. I mean, Mum had mentioned it and we'd looked into it, but it hadn't really occurred to me that it would be a massive issue, because I was like, well, it'll figure itself out. It always will. But then I was watching the news yesterday and it was like, oh, this might happen and that might happen. I think that's the issue. It's all the uncertainty, isn't it?
Mm. Can you find, I mean, did you glean anything from Twitter, or have you been able to find out anything? I guess nobody really knows yet.
Well, that's the issue. So I went on the government website, and that said it will be updated in due course. But what's the date today? Like December the 11th or whatever? 12th? I don't know. The 11th. And I mean, we're potentially coming out in what, for 19, 20 days? And the government still haven't updated their website because I don't think they know yet. And I emailed a immigration lawyer in Jerome today, and she said, if you move out now, we can maybe rush it through. Maybe. It'll be expensive. However, we don't really know what's going to happen after January the 1st, so we'll just have to judge it then and have a meeting with you once you arrive and once we know.
So what, I mean, at the moment, have you got accommodation arranged in Girona?
Yeah, so I've got everything sorted. I'm sharing with another rider who's already based there. And he's fine because he's got an Irish passport. But yeah, I'm due to go out January the 6th. So I was reading about this potential travel ban, and it's a little bit stressful, but I think I'll be able to get away with it because I don't know. Technically, I suppose I can claim pro. I mean, that's an argument in itself, isn't it? Being Conti, is it pro or isn't it pro? But my plan at the minute is to go out and, so the correct thing to do, just wing it and find out what happens when I'm there, kind of thing, and try and get residency. Because what I suppose, if I think about it properly, the worst thing that could happen is I go out there in January, do my 90 out of 180 days, which is supposedly the regulations, and then get to March and I've got to come home and I can't go back out for race season. I mean, that's I don't think that's going to happen, but that is, I suppose, a possibility. How I'm thinking of it is Australians and Americans have, before, they've obviously lived in Spain, and guys have managed to get residency in Spain. I mean, I know this is different because World Tour guys are going to be making multiple times what I will be. So it's a little bit more clear. But I suppose you could argue that even, say, someone on Mitchelton or whatever they're called these days, they don't technically have to be based in Girona full time for their job. I mean, from our perspective, you do. But it's not like there's an office there or anything. And they've still managed to get residency. But yeah, it's an awkward one because there's not even any guidance on what your annual salary has to be or anything to get residency. It kind of just seems to be, well, this is what happened while we were in the EU. What's going to happen next? Oh, well, we'll wait and see on January the 1st and let you know, which is not helpful at all, is it?
And not nice, I would imagine, when, you know, you're putting so much work into training and preparing and really making huge sacrifices to pursue this dream, I suppose, of being a professional cyclist. This is one, you know, any kind of uncertainty is unhelpful, but this must be something that could have and maybe is having quite a negative effect on your state of mind.
Yeah, it's just frustrating. As I said, I'm possibly slightly naively convinced that all is going to be okay because, as you alluded to earlier, we're all thinking kind of worst case scenario. I think it's in, well, politics, I don't want to go into, but I think it's in everyone's best interest to kind of have some sort of open gateway. But yeah, it's weighing my mind a little bit because I want to be living out in Girona both for like training. It's easier to get to races. It's easier to get home from races with the airport. And you're surrounded by like-minded people. And that's the thing in Grimsby, don't get me wrong. The Lincolnshire Wolds are a beautiful place to ride. And there's countless farm tracks and hundreds of miles of empty roads. But there's not the community here. And I think I'd be a better cyclist living out in Girona. And yeah, whether that happens or not, well, I suppose we won't know for another month.
Well, that was Joel Laverick. If anyone's got any advice for him, let us know. Not sure anybody does, though. Listen, Christmas quiz, chaps. I've been inspired by Rose Manley, but I cannot emulate her fantastic quiz, which featured in this month's Cycling Podcast Feminar, which just came out this week. It was very, very well done and entertaining. This is a lot more hastily put together. Just getting my excuses in first. But I've devised a few questions for both of you. Are you ready? Are you ready for this?
Yeah, it sounds like it's going to be crap, but God,
Are you quite competitive? Are you quite competitive, both of you, when it comes to this kind of thing?
What kind of questions can we expect? I don't know. Is it... I don't know. Is there a Pavel Tonkov round?
There aren't even rounds as such. They're just questions. I mean, all I've done is come up with the questions. It's up to you two to be entertaining and funny. Lionel, are you competitive?
Well, if you remember, we played Scrabble with Ned Bolting last year.
Oh yeah, oh god, yeah, you are competitive. Yeah,
Christmas special last year. I really fancied my chances in that, and it turned out to be a lot harder than I imagined to make professional cycling related words from the selection of Scrabble tiles. It was difficult, wasn't it? I can't remember who won, but I suspect if I'd won, I'd remember. So I obviously didn't win.
Okay, well, this is a bit different. Shall we get straight into it, chaps?
Go on.
You ready?
Then. Yeah.
Okay. Some are for Lionel, some are for Daniel, and some are for both.
Okay.
Okay, Lionel, first question. What is Mitch Docker's favourite beer?
Oh, goodness. Oh, these are horrible bouncers, these questions, aren't they? I should know that.
I think I might know.
All right. Okay. Bonus point for Lionel. Daniel, I mean.
Is it an Alhambra?
Nope.
Oh.
Anything cold and wet, I will say.
Orval.
Of course it is. Yeah, that's my favourite Belgian beer as well. Should have known that. Honorary point for knowing that but not being able to answer it.
No. Daniel, what is in a butter pie?
Pastry. I don't know. I've no idea. Pastry and sausage. Beep. I don't know. I've no idea.
I know.
Lionel, bonus point?
Yeah, it's potato and onion.
Well, I actually spoke to Hugh Carthy last week, and this actually brings the first two questions together because he mentions Mitch Docker in here. Let's hear what he had to say about butter pies.
Have you enjoyed any butter pies since you've been back?
I'm not a pie yet. No, I've not been. I went past that bakery the day. I sent Mitch a picture of it, and he wasn't very impressed. he said it looked a bit dodgy. I can't remember what the word he used, a bit rough or something. I can't remember. But yeah. I went by. I'll go next week. I'll get home to and get some. Dad to and get some.
Okay, question for both of you. I fear that you might know this quite easily because we talked about this earlier on. Fingers on the buzzers, please. By how much time did Pog win the time trial at La Planche des Belles Filles?
121.
Oh, suspiciously accurate. Did you look that up?
No, I just remembered.
Did you?
Yeah.
Okay. You're all square.
Come on.
Okay. Okay, Lionel, which country has the most riders in the men's world top 20? These are the UCI rankings. Which country?
Belgium.
Daniel?
I'm going to say...
You look like you're looking at a computer screen. Absolutely appalling. I could see his eyes darting back and forth.
I don't know. Slovenia.
France. Four. Daniel, how many Italians are there in the men's top 20?
I would say... this shows how little I know about the UCI rankings. I don't even know. Were they calculated just on 2020 season? I'm going to say one.
You're correct. Do you know who it is?
I would say Diego Ulisi.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, you get 1.5 points for that, I think. Okay, chaps, the next round's a literary question. Okay, from which book is this passage?
This is...
Mark Cavendish, Boy Racer. No, sorry. Go on.
If only I'd come down with a puncture, How often, fighting away in a long-beaten peloton that nonetheless lay down a hellish tempo I could barely follow, have I longed for a flat tire, a puncture, permission from beyond to stop the dying. For years, something kept me from talking to other riders about that longing, but when I did, it turned out they all knew the feeling. A lot of praying goes on in the peloton. Please let me get a puncture. But the speed of prayer has its limits, so the rider occasionally resorts to more drastic measures. He pounds his wheels through potholes, through gravel, searches for sharp rocks, and perchance, when he has a race to ride but no morale, he'll even mount a carefully selected tube that's ready to blow.
Richard Moore, my story?
No. More Lionel Burney, I think,
Is that The Rider?
The Rider by Tim Crabbe. Well done. Yeah. Which we featured in an episode of Kilometre Zero at the Tour de France, of course. And even spoke to the author himself.
I reread it this summer.
Okay, very good. Well done, Lionel. Lionel, who said there have been 3 sprint stages so far and we've won 4 of them?
It's bound to be somebody. That sounds like the sort of thing Patrick Lefebvre would say.
Someone wasn't listening to our Giro podcast, was he?
I know the answer.
Come on, Daniel.
It's Jacopo Guarnieri.
Correct. He said that during the Giro d'Italia.
Of course he did.
Daniel, who said the following and what were they talking about? Everyone's a gangster until a real gangster walks in.
That's probably something I said.
Correct.
And was it about something to do with...
Alberto Contador Everesting.
Correct.
Well done, Lionel. Your knowledge of Daniel is gains you a point there. So you're level on 3 points each, I think. Lionel. Hang on. Lost my questions. Lionel, who's the top-ranked Colombian in the world on the UCI rankings, and what place is he in?
On the UCI rankings?
Yeah. Without looking it up.
I'm not looking it up, Richard. I'm scrolling through the pull down menus in my mind to think who's had the best results of the Colombians this year. And
It's a surprising one.
Is it still Egan Bernal?
It is not. Well, put you out your misery.
Yeah, go on then.
I think it's Dani Martinez.
Correct, Daniel. Do you know what position he's in?
He wouldn't be in the top 20. I don't know, 25.
34th. Ooh. Quite surprising. Okay, next question for Daniel.
Yes.
Daniel, what is the science and sport discount code? Oh,
the real tragedy of this is I genuinely don't know.
Nonsense.
I genuinely don't know. TCP 25.
SIS CP 25.
Where do I get the TCP from?
Anyway, both of you, from which book is this passage? Due to a set of circumstances that are probably linked to the whims of fate and about which is now too late to complain, he who today writes this article as a reporter assigned to follow the Giro d'Italia has never seen a bicycle road race.
This is the Dino Buzzati 1949 Giro d'Italia book. I don't know what the title of it is, but it's a collection.
The Giro d'Italia.
Correct.
Yeah.
Collection of Dino Buzzati's writings on the 1949 Giro.
Okay. I
got that one.
Oh well. This is terrible.
But it wasn't for me.
Okay, both of you. How many wins did Movistar achieve this year? World Tour.
I'm still reeling from that little.
Actually, no. I think it might just be wins.
I think. I think I can name them. I think there were
three.
Marc Soler in the Challenge Mallorca, Marc Soler in stage 2 of the Vuelta, and
I think that
no, I think there are only two. I think there are only two.
Two, correct. Correct. So not just two wins, not even World Tour.
You're going to give yourself that one, Lionel? Another Trumpian? Another Trumpian?
Yeah, I've given him that one.
Because on his way to three, he passed two. So
yeah.
Okay.
When's Lionel's inauguration?
I must now have an unassailable lead, no, in this quiz. We could probably stop there.
Who had the most race days this year and how many?
Well, that's very difficult, isn't it? I'm going to say Peyo Bilbao and I'm going to say 65.
You're right with Peyo Bilbao.
Seriously?
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And how
71.
Many? Oh, wow. That was a guess.
I was going to guess Tim de Klerk. I don't know why. Do you know how many race days he had?
No, don't know. But that ties in with our latest friend special, not to give too much away.
How many questions left?
No, I can just three left.
Three left. I only ask because I can really feel the suspense building.
Well, it might come down to the last question. Lionel, how many Irishmen won World Tour races this season?
Sam Bennett, Dan Martin. Two.
Correct. Daniel,
yes.
Which Scotsman has joined the Sunweb development team for 2021?
Oh, God. Oh, this feels like if he's listening, I'm sorry. This feels like a terrible affront. Oh, God. Sorry, I just keep thinking of Mark Donovan. No, I don't. I've forgotten his name.
Oscar Onley. From 18, he's from Kelso in the Scottish Borders. And good luck to him. Okay, final question. I mean, it's finally poised because, Daniel, you were on 7 and Lionel, you were on 4. But, Daniel, you lose 3 points for not knowing the science and sport code. So it's all level going into the final question. Fingers on the buzzers, please. Who this year descended like a goat?
Ilnur Zakarin.
Certainly wasn't Lionel Burney. correct, Lionel. Who said it? Who claimed it?
Was it Nans Peters?
Oh, Lionel's a winner. Oh. Lionel wins the quiz.
Oh, fantastic.
Sorry, Daniel.
A bit like a grand tour that's settled on time bonuses. I possibly didn't answer the most questions correctly, yet I've come out on top as the winner.
Can we have a
You've navigated your way around the
can we have a second referendum? Can we have a revote?
You need a sort of Rudy Giuliani figure now, Daniel, to take your case to the courts and appeal. Anyway, there we go.
Well, thanks, Rich.
That's it. That's the Christmas quiz.
Thoroughly enjoyable.
I feel about ready for a glass of sherry now, Rich, after that. I feel very festive.
Oh, dear. Well, I've got a year to prepare for next year's one now. So, that's our last proper episode, isn't it, of the year? We'll be back in 2021, won't we?
We will.
Will we?
We will. Of course we will, yeah.
Calling it a proper episode might be slightly generous, but anyway.
it's been an interesting year, hasn't it, chaps?
It's been a very interesting year, yes. All that uncertainty in the spring about whether there'd be any racing to cover and what we would do, creating our Giro, which, you know, as I look back over the year now, that was one of the highlights of the year, even though, you know, I didn't leave my home. It felt like we travelled around Italy, and speaking of that, I remember promising that we would put the full version of the Max Sciandri interview on the Friends of the Podcast feed, so Richard, remind me to get that organised and we'll put that out sometime between Christmas and New Year. A little dose of Italian sunshine from Max Sciandri probably go down quite well over the festive period for people. What does 2021 have in store? That's the big question.
That's the big question. What does it have in store, Daniel?
Not sure, Rich. Not sure. Hopefully it will be a better year for everyone concerned, all the listeners. Any recommendations, chat to our listeners? Maybe we'll put some things on Twitter for things to enjoy, entertain them. Obviously, apart from the podcast, during the festive season, I watched a good documentary last night called The Red Penguins, about the Pittsburgh Penguins' ill-fated attempt to make a splash in Russian ice hockey. That was very good.
That was excellent, wasn't it? That's one of the Storyville films, isn't it?
Yes.
It's on the BBC iPlayer. I saw that the other day. Yeah, I'd second that recommendation. Very enjoyable. Well, we will actually, over the festive period, we'll be posting on Twitter and Facebook some of our favourite episodes from this year for people to dip in and out of if you're looking for something to listen to. There'll be stuff going on to the Friends of the Podcast feed, as I said, over the Christmas period. And, well, if you haven't caught up with Daniel, you mentioned Wackaday and whether Tadej Pogacar, I'm not sure they showed Wackaday in Slovenia. We'll have to check with our Slovenian friends. But
he was in the Vosges at the time. He was in Alsace at the time on the morning of the penultimate daytime trial in the Tour. Anyway, go on.
But would he have been watching? I'm not sure they were showing. You know, Wackaday finished about 25 years ago on TV. So, but one of the hosts of Wackaday, Timmy Mallett, featured in the most recent episode of Explore. An eclectic crossover, that long distance cycling and the host of Wackaday, famous of course for Mallet's Mallet. If you're wondering what on earth I'm talking about, just check out the most recent episode of Explore, which is called Utterly
Which
Brilliant.
Has had an extraordinary response. People seem to have really enjoyed hearing from Timmy Mallett. So yeah, it's the latest episode of Explore. And I gather you were interrogated last week by Orla, Lionel, for the next introducing one of us episodes.
That,
in this case, you.
You've now put that into the public domain. Thank you, Richard. Yes, I've been trying to wriggle out of that. I think I made a comment in the most recent Friends special where we discuss all of the best friends of the podcast ideas. I said you said it was coming up soon, and I misunderstood what you meant and thought you were referring to the My First Tour series, which we created in July when the Tour de France should have been on. And you said, who's going to interview you for this? And I said, Orla, because she'll be a bit more sympathetic, perhaps. And yeah, she was very, very. It was actually a more enjoyable experience than I had
than it would have been if it had been us interviewing you.
You what? Sorry.
Than it would have been if it had been us interviewing you.
Well, no, I just. Yes, yeah, you're right. That's absolutely right. That's what I mean. Yeah. But I mean, we're not putting that out at Christmas, are we? We're not going to ruin people's Christmas by putting that out now. We'll save that.
No. And not in January either. leave it until the spring and start feeling cheerful again.
Yeah, leave it until the pandemic's over, eh? Until we're all vaccinated.
On that note, there's one bonus episode coming next week for Amaraterra fans, but that's it from us for this year from a cycling point of view. Thank you very much, everybody, for listening. We really appreciate the messages that we've had from people who've obviously enjoyed a bit of an escape from reality at times this year, and we've been pleased to be able to keep going. And we look forward to a more normal year next year. But thank you very much indeed for all your comments. And actually, just before we go, a little shout out for a couple of people. Dominic Davenport, he's an orthopaedic surgeon. I think his wife was in touch recently buying some books from us. But she said that he listens to the podcast each week and it's kept him going during a very hard year working throughout the COVID pandemic. So, yeah, Dominic Davenport, an orthopaedic surgeon, thank you very much for listening, and we appreciate your support. Marcus Banks, another orthopaedic surgeon as well, long-time correspondent. He also replaced my hip a few years ago. He's been in touch telling us about his links with Larry Warbass and saying that he's very excited at the prospect of the casquette and tea towel combo arriving in the new year. So thank you, Marcus. Thank you, Dominic. And thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, and Merry Christmas to all our listeners.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Rich, and Happy New Year to all of our listeners. We'll see you in 2021.